We have lots to do today. Let's have the committee come to order. We're still short of a quorum, so I think we will go ahead and hear from our the OLA today. So we've asked the legislative auditor to present a report on the Minnesota Department of Health's Office of Health Facilities Complaints, OHFC. Sorry, that's a mouthful. We welcome Jim Nobles, the legislative auditor, and Judy Randall, the deputy legislative auditor. And with that, would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record? And
thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Judy Randall, who is deputy legislative auditor for the Program Evaluation Division. She was also the manager of the evaluation that we are going to be presenting today. Before I turn it over to Judy, I want to say just a few brief things. First, Madam Chair and members of the Joint Committee, thank you for this opportunity to visit with you about a serious problem in state government. That problem, as you already know, is the failure of the Department of Health to ensure that the Office of Health Facilities Complaints fulfilled its responsibility to promptly and effectively investigate allegations of maltreatment of vulnerable adults by health providers. As you also know, the administration is starting to address the problems at OHFC, and we applaud those efforts. But no one should think that the problems at OHFC have been solved because the backlog has been reduced, there is a new commissioner in charge, and the Department of Human Services has been brought in to help. As you will learn from reading our report and from Ms. Randall's presentation this morning, the problems at OHFC are deep and pervasive, and they have been there a long time. They are rooted in poor management that was tolerated and ignored far too long. That poor management not only failed vulnerable adults, it failed the good state employees at OHFC who were trying to serve them. Those employees take on very difficult assignments every day, but for far too long they had to work in a culture and an environment that was dysfunctional and sometimes even toxic. So the path forward must include serving vulnerable adults and their families better. But it must also focus on creating a supportive work environment for the staff at OHFC. The path forward should also include a hard look at the regulatory structure. The service industry for vulnerable adults has changed, and the regulatory structure needs to catch up. So with that, Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Randall for a presentation of our report.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Ms. Randall, could you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. As Mr. Nobles said, I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division, and I also had the privilege of being the manager on our evaluation of OHFC. Before I get started, I would like to acknowledge the very hardworking team I had on this project. They're seated behind me, Laura Schwartz and Catherine Tyson. Let me just start with kind of our bottom line conclusion, which is that OHFC has not met its responsibilities to protect vulnerable adults in Minnesota. And we, through the work we did, we kind of categorized the root causes into two main categories. One, as Mr. Nobles talked about, is the internal operations at OHFC. And the second is Minnesota's regulatory structure. So I'm going to dive into both of those root causes and talk about solutions and recommendations for going forward. Before I do that, I just want to take a step back, make sure we're all on the same page to understand what OHFC does, who they are, and just a better understanding of their work. As you'll quickly come to understand, if you don't already know, it's really quite complex. So let's just place OHFC where it is. It's in the Department of Health, in the Health Regulation Division. The Health Regulation Division is responsible for licensing and regulation of health care providers. Within OHFC, there are about 50 people on staff. You can see there's a director, assistant director, and then other staff. About half the staff are investigators. Three-quarters of them or so are registered nurses. Some of them come to the office with investigator experience or law enforcement experience. OHFC is responsible for investigating allegations of maltreatment, and they're also responsible for investigating licensing violations. The Vulnerable Adults Act defines what maltreatment is and categorizes it as abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. And licensing violations can take two different forms. There are state licensing violations, and then there are also federal licensing violations. Of course, the federal ones apply only to those federally certified providers, and the state licensing violations, of course, only apply to providers that are licensed by the state. OHFC has jurisdiction over providers licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health. So this includes nursing homes, hospitals, and it also includes home care providers that may operate in a variety of locations. They may visit their patients or clients in their home, or they may visit them in their home, which is actually within a housing with services establishment. If it hasn't kind of already become apparent, this is a really complex area of law. There's federal law, there's state law, there's different types of providers, there's different locations. And depending on the intersection of those things, what type of provider and whether they're licensed or federally certified, different rules will apply. Because the bulk of OHFC's work focuses on a vulnerable adult, I think it's really important that we all understand who is a vulnerable adult. And again, this is outlined and defined in the state's Vulnerable Adults Act. But a vulnerable adult is anyone who's 18 years or older and is either a resident of a facility, of a licensed facility, such as a nursing home, receives certain services licensed by the state, for example, from a home care provider, or is somebody who has an infirmity that impairs their ability to protect themselves from maltreatment. I know that there's a lot of conversation around elder abuse, and certainly that's a big piece of maltreatment of vulnerable adults, but I think it's important to understand that a vulnerable adult could be anybody who's 18 or older. So it's not only our senior population. All right, so let's move towards allegation reports and how that works. OHFC receives allegation reports from multiple sources. So let's say my mom is in a nursing home and I go visit her and I'm concerned about the care she is receiving. I have a couple different avenues that I can use to report my concern to the state. I can contact the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, and I know last week the subcommittee heard quite a bit about MARC. I could also directly contact OHFC through phone call or email. And then nursing homes actually, up until very recently, had a separate reporting system. They would report concerns through the nursing home incident reporting system. So let me point out that these allegation reports can come from a variety of people. They can come from family members. They can come from the vulnerable adults. They can come from the providers themselves. And these allegation reports come in through a variety of ways. MARC and the Nursing Home Incident Reporting System are both electronic systems, and about 95% of the allegation reports eventually make their way to OHFC through one of those two systems.
Excuse me, Ms. Randall, for a minute. Members, I just want to point out that we now have a quorum, so I will address the minutes after we are done with the report. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have heard, I think, a lot in recent months about the workload that OHFC has. And yes, indeed, their workload has increased significantly over the past several years. Between fiscal years 2012 and 2017, the number of allegation reports coming into OHFC has increased by more than 50%. Similarly, the number of investigations the office has conducted has also increased by more than 50% over the past six fiscal years. Now, because both the number of allegation reports increased by around 50% and the number of investigations increased by around 50%, the percentage of allegation reports that actually get investigated has remained pretty stable during this time period. They investigate between 3 and 5% of the allegation reports they receive. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about OHFC's process. So, again, let's say I have my mother is in a nursing home, and I go visit her, and I can tell something's wrong. And upon talking with the nurse, I can realize, you know what, I think she got the wrong dosage of medicine. Something did not go properly in her care. I can call that allegation in to Mark, and that allegation report gets routed to OHFC. OHFC then, the intake staff take that report, and I think until very recently, and the department can talk a little bit about some of the changes they're making, but at least during the time frame we evaluated them, they would print out that intake report and then send it to triage staff. The triage staff at OHFC are the people responsible for determining whether or not the allegation should be investigated. They also decide how quickly it needs to be investigated, how serious is the allegation. Because medication errors, what happened with my mom, this is fictional, but just for clarity. So because a medication error is a serious concern that would affect not only my mom but potentially other residents if proper protocols aren't in place, OHFC would likely decide to investigate this allegation. So then they would sign the allegation report to an investigator who would conduct an on-site investigation. So this means the investigator would go to the nursing home, would talk to my mom, would talk to other residents, would talk to staff, would look at medical records, would probably watch staff administer other medication and check the protocol. So they spend, you know, at least a day, usually sometimes longer, on site, really reviewing the protocols. They also, when they go back to the office, then would look at additional records. Maybe they'd call the hospital if she had been admitted to a hospital and do additional work. Eventually, the investigator makes a determination to determine whether or not the maltreatment happened, whether or not this is a substantiated maltreatment allegation. They'd also determine whether there were licensing violations that happened in the wrong medication given to my mother. They would prepare and distribute an investigation report. And then, depending on the outcome of the investigation and depending on who you are, you may have an opportunity to appeal the determination. And then depending on the extent to which the provider corrected the problems, there could be enforcement actions. So I kind of did high-level overview of their process, but hopefully that helps give a little understanding of the nature of the work that staff at OHFC do. Okay, so now that we've done that, let me talk a little bit about some of the scope of the problems that we found at OHFC. I'm going to focus on missed deadlines because I think it's the most tangible thing to understand kind of some of the failings of the office. There are a lot of requirements, a lot of different deadlines for the work that OHFC does. Again, depending on if it's a state licensed provider or a federally licensed or federally certified provider, there are different deadlines that that apply, requiring them to make a triage decision within a certain amount of time, so decide whether or not to investigate within a certain amount of time. There are certain requirements about how quickly they need to get on site to conduct the investigation, and there are requirements about how quickly they need to conclude the investigation. So there are a lot of different timelines that apply. I'm not going to go through all of them here. I'm just going to use two to kind of illustrate some of the problems that we found. So the first one I want to talk about is regarding a two-day requirement for investigators to get on site. Federal law, this is where some of the complexity will come in. Federal law requires OHFC to get on site to investigate immediate jeopardy, I'll explain what that is, immediate jeopardy allegations within 2 days of federally certified nursing homes. So an immediate jeopardy allegation is kind of the most serious allegation. It's the one where a vulnerable adult has actually experienced serious harm or has the potential for serious harm, or there could be a widespread concern about serious harm. Examples of this would be a medication error that resulted in the death of a vulnerable adult or a sexual assault. So we're talking about really serious allegation reports. So again, the requirement under federal regulations is that OHFC get on site to investigate these most serious allegations in federally certified nursing homes within 2 days. And in fiscal year 17, OHFC met that requirement for 17% of the cases. Again, this is for those very serious concerns. Another deadline that's required for all investigations, this is in state law. state law requires that OHFC conclude its investigation of all allegation reports that it investigates within 60 days of receiving the allegation report. And in fiscal year 17, they met that 60-day deadline for 12% of the cases. So why does this matter? Right? Why does it matter if they're meeting the deadlines? Well, there's a couple of reasons. Oh, I'm sorry. Before I get into why it matters, though, I do want to point you to page 61 in the report, because I think it shows also the extent of the problem. Again, looking at page 61, this is talking about that 60-day deadline. It's not that OHFC missed the deadline by 1 or 2 days. The graph in Exhibit 4.4 shows how long it took OHFC to complete its investigations. And on average, it took them about 140 days to complete an investigation. That state law requires to be completed in 60 days. So just wanted to give you a little bit of the breadth of some of the problems we saw. All right, now let's talk about why it matters. Well, we think this matters for a couple of reasons. One, it's required in law. So, you know, that's important. But this timeline and the missed deadlines really matters to the people who are affected by these allegation reports. Certainly it matters to the vulnerable adult and their families who are waiting for some resolution. It matters to providers who are waiting for a determination from OHFC to figure out what they should do with their staff. If one of their staff people is accused of abusing a vulnerable adult, they need to figure out, should they put that person on leave? Should they fire that person? Should they keep that person on staff? So it has ramifications for providers, too. We also think it can affect the integrity of the investigation itself. As part of our evaluation, we conducted a file review. We looked at 50 allegation reports that were not investigated, and we looked at 53 allegation reports that were investigated. And what we found looking at the files that were investigated, that it took OHFC on average 38 days before they interviewed the vulnerable adult. So they received an allegation report, and then on average, they didn't interview the vulnerable adult about that incident until 38 days later. I don't know what I did last week, honestly. You know, so to remember what happened 38 days ago for a vulnerable adult, we think that can really affect the quality of information investigators are getting in their investigations. Similarly, OHFC investigators on average interviewed the alleged perpetrator 75 days after the allegation report was received. Again, they're supposed to conclude investigations within 60 days, and they're interviewing the alleged perpetrator 75 days. So, again, we think these deadlines can also affect the quality of the investigation. All right, so now let's turn to, well, why is this happening? What's going on that OHFC is struggling so much with its work? And as Mr. Nobles mentioned, we found that OHFC has been poorly managed, and this kind of runs across different dimensions of the office. The first is something that I believe the legislature has heard quite a bit about, which is their case management system. They largely rely on a paper-based system, and this has ramifications for resource allocation. Supervisors, for example, do not necessarily know the caseload of their investigators. If they want to know how many open cases one of their staff has, they need to go actually count the paper files on their desk. They also don't necessarily know maybe who the best person is to assign to a case based on their whole workload. Instead, sometimes cases are assigned to investigators based on who's available to go out next day to the nursing home or to visit the provider. This also means there's a lot of data that's not being collected. OHFC could be a treasure trove of data. There's so much data that they could be collecting, but instead it's kind of sitting in these paper files. And as we talk in the report a bit about possible prevention strategies, which ultimately I think would be the goal, collecting reliable data and then using that data is a key strand to prevention. And it's something that the office really can't do effectively, especially with its current case management system. As part of our evaluation, we surveyed OHFC staff. And we heard from 49 of 50 of the staff that were working at the time of our survey. So we got a 98% response rate, which was pretty remarkable. And we heard through those surveys, and we also saw as we looked through the documents, that OHFC has a number of unwritten policies and their policies change kind of regularly and without being formally communicated. In their survey responses, staff told us that they were glad that they were in the room when a policy changed, because otherwise they didn't necessarily hear about it. They also told us that sometimes there just weren't policies, and so they would do what they thought made sense, and then if they didn't hear it was wrong, they assumed it was right. There aren't policies about who investigators should interview. There aren't policies or protocols for kind of standard types of investigations that the office would routinely do, such as, you know, concerns related to a mechanical lift or something like that. Staff also told us they found the training to be ineffective. And kind of in part because of this and because of the culture in general, we found very high levels of staff turnover at the office. Based on the survey responses, almost 50% of staff had been with OHSC for less than 2 years. If you remember what I kind of said at the beginning about how complex an area this is with federal law and state law and different types of providers, it takes a while for staff, you know, investigators in particular, to get trained. They told us it took 1 to 2 years to really become good at their job. So if you're having that much turnover, it really makes it difficult for the office to be effective at its response in executing its responsibilities. We also found quite a bit of lack of confidence in the leadership there. And if I could direct you again in the report to page 19, that exhibit, page 19, exhibit 2.1, shows kind of some of the survey results that we have based on the office culture. And you can see, so the blue bars are agree and the orange bars are disagree. And you can see that staff feel respected by their peers, they're proud to work at the office, but 60% did not have confidence in OHSC senior leadership, and just over 60% did not think the office did a good job of communicating goals and strategy of the office. You know, as Mr. Nobles talked about, this is a really hard job. As part of our evaluation, we accompanied investigators on 10 investigations. So we shadowed them on their doing their work in the nursing home, in assisted living facilities, visiting home care providers, investigating abuse, neglect, financial exploitation. And all three of us that went out on these site visits were all incredibly impressed with the staff, the compassion and kindness they showed the residents when they met with them and when they talked with staff, the way they looked at records. I mean, this is a hard job, and they're going in and investigating hard things, and they are doing it because they have the vulnerable adult in mind. And, you know, we think that's really impressive, but it's really hard to do in an office that doesn't have some of these basic management systems in place. On the slide here, we pulled out just one of the quotes. There were so many to choose from the survey, but we thought this one kind of wrapped up the sentiment really well. I'll just read it aloud. Somebody said, "I really think the work we do here is so valuable, but it's hard to be proud and want to stay at a job with a broken process. I feel like I can't do a thorough job on my cases because the work just keeps piling up. It's not fair to the vulnerable adult." And, I mean, we thought that was really important because it really does put the vulnerable adult at the center of the work they do. And I think that's why everybody here cares so much about getting this function working as well as it can be. All right, so let's start looking towards some recommendations and some solutions. In our report, we have a very long list of recommendations. I believe they start on page 91. But let me just highlight some of the key ones that we address to OHSC and the Department of Health. So we recommend that OHSC implement an electronic case management system, develop written policies, and improve its training program. I don't think I need to explain those more based on the stuff I've already talked about. We also think that the Department of Health Commissioner's Office really needs to play a continued strong role in overseeing OHSC. In the past couple months, I think the Commissioner's Office has really engaged more in the oversight of this office. And as you know, and as I'm sure the department will testify to, the Department of Health has entered into an interagency partnership with the Department of Human Services. They've told us that they've been able to address the backlog of cases, and DHS, I think, is coming in and taking is really helping a lot, and we think that is great. We think this partnership is a really good first step, but it doesn't solve it for the long term, not yet. Getting rid of the backlog is a necessary step, absolutely, but it's not sufficient. There needs to be continued long-term improvements in this office to make sure we don't get another backlog. It took a long time, I think, for the problems to get as bad as they are, and it's going to take a long time to get it back to where it needs to be. So, again, I think we applaud the department and DHS for the work they've done so far, but I just want to emphasize that there's still a lot of work to do. We have a number of other recommendations for OHFC. I'm happy to answer questions about them if members are interested in particular ones. There's a whole bunch that focus on issues around communication. We have a lot of concerns about the website OHFC has, which is supposed to provide really good consumer education. So if I'm looking for a nursing home for my mom, I can go out and investigate or do some research to see if there's been investigation reports related to the ones I'm considering. And there's, we think the not all the information is up there that should be up there, and it's does not operate well. There's other communication recommendations related to notifying folks of delays, notifying people of their appeals rights, things like that. Excuse me. We also recommend that the department do a better job of collecting data and analyzing data. I mentioned this a little bit with its ineffective case management system. OHFC does have a complaints database right now that's called Paradise. Data are entered into that inconsistently or not at all. The data in there are not reliable. Ms. Schwartz on our team spent 10 months digging into that database to be able to pull out the information that we have. So we think, again, using data is a great prevention strategy. Along with the consumer education on the website is a great prevention strategy, and we think these are both areas that OHFC and the department need to improve. And then finally, we also recommend improving implementing some quality control procedures. When an allegation report comes into OHFC, remember I talked about the triage person, and they're deciding whether or not the allegation report is investigated or not. If the allegation report is going to be investigated, if it's triaged for investigation, then a supervisor reviews that allegation report. If an allegation report is triaged to not be investigated, nobody else looks at that decision. So we think there needs to be some spot checks or some random quality control to make sure that we're making the right decisions about what is and isn't going to be investigated. We have similar recommendations related to quality control aspects of investigations. All right, so the problems that we found at OHSC, I want to switch gears to kind of the second strand of the root cause of the problem. You know, I said there's a big problem. Part of it is OHSC internal operations, and part of it is the regulatory structure. OHSC isn't functioning just because of its management problems. There's a really complex regulatory structure, and this is where we think the legislature has a role. Let me just take a step back again to make sure everybody has an understanding of the landscape. There are several agencies that have responsibility for investigating maltreatment of vulnerable adults. The Department of Health and OHSC investigates allegations related to providers licensed by MDH. DHS has a unit that investigates allegations related to providers licensed by DHS. And then county social services agencies also have a role for maltreatment that happens by folks who aren't licensed or alleged to have occurred by those who aren't licensed. Because of these different layers, jurisdiction can sometimes be difficult to determine. So on the slide, you see kind of two buildings. One is a nursing home. That's easy. That's licensed by the Department of Health. Everything that happens in that facility, OHFC and the Department of Health have jurisdiction over. The second building is a housing with services establishment. And assisted living facilities are one type of housing with services establishment. Within that facility, there can be lots of different providers coming to give services to the folks in that assisted living facility or housing with services establishment. You could have a home care provider that's licensed by the Department of Health, and OHFC would have jurisdiction to investigate allegations of maltreatment by that MDH-licensed home care provider. You could have another home care provider that's licensed by DHS, and OHFC would not have jurisdiction over the services provided by that provider. Instead, DHS would have jurisdiction to investigate allegations of maltreatment by that licensed provider. Or you could have someone who's not licensed or a family member in that facility helping or providing services. And in that case, it would be the counties who had jurisdiction over that service provider. So you can see that it can be really complex. As part of our evaluation, we went on 10 investigations. On three of those 10 investigations, investigators spent several hours determining whether or not they actually had jurisdiction to investigate the case. So this is a case that had come into OHFC, been triaged for investigation, been assigned to an investigator. The investigator went out. We went with them. We get on site, and all of a sudden it's not clear. Is it actually OHFC's jurisdiction? In two of the 10 cases, they didn't have jurisdiction. So the investigator and our team spent, several hours there on site only to determine, we don't have jurisdiction, and they went back to the office. That allegation report then got routed back to Mark, and then, in theory, back to the correct person. But again, in an office that is really, overwhelmed with work right now, to have to spend time in areas where they actually don't have jurisdiction is really not the best use of resources. So in Minnesota, in addition to these jurisdiction issues, we found some gaps in the regulatory protections that are established in Minnesota law. So in Minnesota, the regulatory protections vary based on the facility, not the vulnerability of the people who they serve. So, for example, in Minnesota, nursing homes, home care providers, hospitals, they're all licensed by the Department of Health, and they therefore have regular inspections. OHFC has clear jurisdiction, and there are specific requirements outlined in law so that when there is an allegation of maltreatment, investigators can go and hold them accountable to standards written in law. The same is not true with housing with services establishments. Housing with service establishments are registered, and they're not licensed. So this means that they're not regularly inspected. OHFC does not have jurisdiction, again, of the facility, different than the people within maybe providing other services. And there's therefore limited oversight of the facility. I think one of the best ways to think about this is to think of my mom and think of a vulnerable adult in your life. I don't think you know my mom, but you know what I mean? Think of a loved one you have who has dementia. Okay? If your loved one with dementia is in a nursing home, there are requirements in law about what types of protections need to be in place, about the types of doors that need to lock to prevent your loved one from going out in the cold night air, types of supervision. There's requirements in law. And so if my mom with dementia living in a nursing home dementia unit walked out into the night and I found out and somebody reported it to the state, there would be a way to hold that nursing home accountable to say, you didn't meet the requirements in law, you didn't supervise, you didn't provide the type of care we were expecting. Now picture your loved one, or my mom, in a dementia unit in a housing with services establishment. And again, she somehow walks out of the facility. There's nothing in law to hold them accountable for that. There's nothing to say, you should have had locked doors or that, you should have supervised in a different way. The requirements in law for the same person, for the same level of vulnerability, is different depending on the type of provider, the type of facility that we have. So we have recommendations to the legislature to look at that. We recommend a legislative work group where you can really gather input from all of the key stakeholders. We think legislators should serve on this work group. We think this needs some time to really look at what the state wants to do in terms of protecting vulnerable adults and what the best way to do that is. In the Vulnerable Adults Act, the state has a stated policy of protecting vulnerable adults in Minnesota. And so we think that the legislature should develop a work group to really look to see, does the regulatory structure in place really best serve that policy? We think you should gather input from all the different folks. I know the governor's work group provided a recent report that we think provides some really good input. That's a starting point, absolutely. But we think you also need to hear from some other stakeholders, the providers and state agencies and other folks. We also think that this work group should try to have a narrow focus on licensure and the regulatory structure. I know that there are a lot of issues to address, and I think there would be a tendency towards some scope creep in the legislative work group, but I guess our recommendation is to really try to focus on the licensure and regulatory structure so that really progress can be made there. I think once that's in place, other things can come from that. We have several other legislative recommendations in the report. The first is really to continue to hold OHFC accountable. We have a large number of recommendations to OHFC, and we think that they should regularly report back to this committee on their progress. So we do recommend that you require them to regularly check in with you on their progress. We didn't touch on it much, and I'm happy to talk about it more if there's questions, but we do think that a look at the state's enforcement actions that are available, the types of fines, when fines can be levied against providers that have substantiated maltreatment, we think it's worth taking another look at that. We also think the legislature should amend the law to allow OHFC to inform vulnerable adults if there has been an allegation report submitted that involves them. And so just to explain that one a little bit more, if, you know, I'm upset because my mom in the nursing home got the wrong medication, and I complain to the nursing home administrator, and they say, absolutely, that was a mistake, we're sorry, and we'll report it to the state. You know, we need to report this, and we will. And I say, okay, great. I have no way of knowing if they actually reported it or if what they reported was accurate. If I called up OHFC to ask for that information, they wouldn't provide it to me based on the law and restrictions on sharing that type of data. So we do think the law should be changed to allow sharing of that type of information. And then we also think that the legislature should require OHFC to post all of its investigation reports on its website. They currently do not post all of their investigations, and we think that's a really important part of consumer education, which can lead to some prevention. You know, it's part of a prevention strategy. Again, the state has a long way to go on prevention, but some of these recommendations we think can move the ball forward a little bit. So, Madam Chair, I've covered a lot of ground. I'm happy to take questions, and I'll take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. I really appreciate your work. I know this took quite a long time and was difficult. Members, we're going to ask Commissioner Malcolm to come down and give us a little bit of a response before we start asking questions of the auditor. So, Commissioner, yeah, there we are. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. We really appreciate the opportunity to address the Office of the Legislators, of the Legislative Auditors, really quite extraordinary and I think incredibly helpful report. Their evaluation, as you just heard, raises a number of serious and important issues, and we're just extremely thankful for the diligence that they brought to this task. We have a detailed response letter included at the end of the report, and in the interest of time, I won't go through each of the individual recommendations at this time, but I would like to point out that I agree with virtually every one of them, at least in terms of the spirit and the substance of the recommendation. I'd like to make my comments in really three categories, if you will, just to very briefly highlight for you what has already been accomplished in collaboration with our terrific partners at the Department of Human Services since the auditor was on site at the Health Department. Second, I'll give you a sense of what we're currently working on. And finally, I want to strongly support the recommendations that the auditor has made for legislative action. First, as I think you are well aware, due to the evaluation's timeline, a number of the findings and recommendations reflect the state of OHFC operations as they existed prior to the beginning of the interagency agreement. Since December, as you have already heard from the department and from the auditors just now, we've made urgently needed progress on improving the operations and the work product of OHFC to respond to the backlog of elder treatments and vulnerable adult treatment complaints. And as of February 28th, we have publicly reported that we have completed reviewing and assigning all 2,300 of the complaint reports that were awaiting triage. So when we speak about eliminating the triage backlog, we're referring to that that group of cases that had built up unacceptably over time. The second backlog refers to the open investigations, of which there were 826 in early December. That open investigation backlog has also been reduced almost in half. 430 investigations are still in the process at various stages. This really remarkable and rapid progress is thanks in very large part to the interagency partnership with DHS. That partnership provided a framework for a core team of experts from DHS in continuous improvement, as well as their Office of Inspector General, who had worked through very similar reengineering processes at DHS several years ago. It allowed for those staff to come and join us, literally shoulder to shoulder in OHFC, to work closely with us on process and system redesign, as well as contributing additional experienced hands on deck, if you will, to help us review and address and assess and process some of this backlog at various stages. We have already begun to install new workflows and now have in place a short-term electronic document management system to help us keep pace with the 400 or so new complaints that are submitted to OHFC each week. We are now properly assessing status for triage as a result of these new workflows so that we are meeting the timelines of assigning complaints to whether they need to be reviewed within 2 days or 10 days. So we're beginning the process and have already automated a piece of what the auditors correctly described as an antiquated paper-based system, but that certainly was not helping with this issue. I would just agree wholeheartedly with the auditors that this progress, while extremely impressive, staff have been working very hard to achieve this, is a first step, and necessary but not sufficient is a very good way to describe it. I do want to also mention that as part of the redesigned workflows, we are doing auditing to ensure that the case reviews and the assignments into different statuses are conducted and documented in a consistent manner. Improving staff training has been a very key focus of the interagency partnership and already has resulted in a series of new decision tools that are now being used by the intake and triage staff, and a number of documented standardized processes at various points along the way of this pretty complex work stream. As I mentioned, there is now electronic document management system, an interim solution before the ultimate system is built, that is in place, and staff have been trained to use that. We are also beginning the critical need for investigator training to ensure more consistent processes. So that is all work that is begun, certainly not completed, but many of the recommendations that the auditors have made for improved processes and training we completely agree with and are working hard to implement and already have begun to do so. The recommendation that the commissioner's office should play a stronger role in overseeing OHFC, I also completely agree with. Beginning in December, then acting commissioner and our continuing deputy commissioner, Dan Pollack, convened an incident command structure on this resolution of not only of the backlog, but on overseeing improvements in OHFC, and that is still operational to this day. We've had a committed and sincere effort by the very highest levels of both the Health Department and the Department of Human Services on this interagency partnership. It is a very creative and great example of how agencies can combine expertise and learn from each other when they have encountered and solved similar problems in the past. And I look forward to continuing to work with DHS to harvest what we have learned about how our work relates to each other. My office will continue to provide direct leadership to the OHFC to ensure success in this ongoing improvement process, in the better management that the legislative auditor calls for, and a culture of respect in this program. So there is a lot of work that's been begun, and sort of the next stage of our work in progress. I'll just tick through a few of those items right now. We certainly agree that the OHFC program and the affiliated licensing and survey operations at the Health Department require a new case management system to replace the existing antiquated Paradise system. We're in the process of evaluating and pricing out options to do that, including but not limited to looking at using the same case management system that DHS currently does. This is a rather complex task with IT implications and implications for how these systems need to respond to the different requirements that CMS has for different populations and for our two agencies. We're just in the beginning to consult with legislative decision makers to evaluate these options, and we'll ultimately select a new electronic case management system. We intend to have a request for information out into the community on to give us some ideas and some advice on how we might pursue this. We intend to get that request for information out in early April of this year. We're also working hard to address staff turnover and low morale, which, as the auditors have pointed out, is a multifaceted issue. And I am very grateful, actually, to Mr. Nobles and Ms. Randall for their acknowledgement of the mission commitment and the caring that the OHFC staff exhibit. I've had the chance to see and hear from them as well about this, and strongly believe that they are committed and fully understand the importance of their work. And I agree with the auditor's characterization that the system has failed the staff, and that any rebuilding of the culture and the morale needs to take that very seriously. Another item that we are working hard on now, another recommendation, was that we could do a better job of helping providers to know how to make appropriate reporting decisions. Providers have shared with us, and I'm sure have with you as well, that they believe that they are the best strategy for them is to report everything in an abundance of caution, which is part of what leads to the high volume. So better supports and decision guides will be helpful to all of us in making sure that complaints come into the right investigation process, and that the providers feel like they are well educated on what is to be reported, which is quite specifically defined by the federal government and by the State Vulnerable Adults Act. So we're currently looking at how best to do that, how to provide additional guidance to providers so that they have these resources available, and we'll continue to talk with them. On the data and prevention front, I completely agree that there is great opportunity to use what we learn in the investigation and complaint process to turn that into the same kind of proactive public health approaches we take on so many other issues, and we are committed to doing that. We have assigned a data analyst to begin to look at what we currently have and what we don't have that we would need in order to make a more robust prevention process, and how we need to change things like what data are collected in order to lend themselves to valid trend analysis that we could report back to providers. We're going to start immediately to build a comprehensive prevention plan in consultation with consumers and providers, using the legislative auditor's report recommendations as a starting point. So that kind of covers progress we have made and are in the process already of implementing. But the third really set of remarks has to do with the recommendations that are needed to move us beyond this point. We are fully committed to meeting our current law obligations, and I am confident that we are well on the way to doing that. However, as the auditors have pointed out, a more systemic look at what is causing problems in the care of vulnerable adults in Minnesota is a much bigger picture and will require discussion and eventual action by the legislature. We agree, for example, that we need better direction from the legislature and changes to statute to clarify how and when we can inform vulnerable adults and their families, legal representatives, when providers have filed a suit and what the nature of the disposition is. Another recommendation to improve communication was to modernize our website and make it a lot easier to navigate. While we certainly agree that improvements are needed, those kinds of technology improvements have not been funded previously. We'll work with the legislature and the governor's office to explore ways to implement this website recommendation. We will also work with the governor's office and with the legislature on the question of statutory authority and any funding necessary to do the kinds of increased trend analysis and changes in access to data for prevention. I'd like to end by emphasizing the importance of the legislative auditor's excellent review of the critical gaps in Minnesota's current regulatory approach to both the providers and the settings in which vulnerable adults live and receive essential services. It's unacceptably difficult for persons served, families, and providers to know what is regulated, under which rules, and by which agencies, or whether there are actually no regulations pertinent for specific services or settings. As the legislative auditor and the consumer work group commissioned by Governor Dayton have both pointed out, current laws on vulnerable adults in Minnesota are confusing, complex, and frustrating to all parties, I'm sure including the legislature, and this will take legislative action to address. As Auditor Noble said in his opening remarks, this work is begun but not completed. We are fully committed to pursuing these legislative ideas as well as our own operational improvements, and we thank the auditor and the deputy auditor for the very thorough evaluation and clear recommendations and roadmap that they have provided to us. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm sure we will all be pleased to answer your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. Members, at this time we will take some questions. Ms. Randall, would you please join us back at the desk? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And boy, it's disconcerting that we have issues and we're actually addressing the investigation of, you know, the real problems of, you know, what's happening with vulnerable adults. It seems as if it's bifurcated in that you've got some individuals that should not be, involved with, the care of vulnerable adults, and you've got systematic training. Who do you go to? When I look at vulnerable, I think of we've done a lot of activity for children, and we've got fairly decent systems installed. We've got statewide umbrella, and then the counties have well-defined activities. There are, visits, inspections, and et cetera. There are criteria for unlicensed facilities. So has there been a look at, comparatively, when you do the recommendations, what's involved maybe with the, child care mechanisms and structure to assist us in, recreating something that will work for vulnerable adults?
Ms. Randall.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, thanks for the question. I think it's a good way to think about it. I agree. Vulnerable adults and children are both vulnerable and need the probably same levels of oversight and protection by the state. We did not take an in-depth look at comparing those two systems. I know that OHFC is responsible for responding to maltreatment of minors in providers that they license, and so DHS would do the same for the providers it licenses. So I think the system, at least as it currently is structured, is separated by who licenses the facility and not by the age of the person who is vulnerable. And perhaps Commissioner Malcolm wants to jump in.
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I think it's a great suggestion that we should at least look at that framework and see what might apply. I think as the auditor's report mentions, part of the issue is just is the rapid growth in the population of adults. Of adults with different vulnerabilities and the literal explosion in the numbers and types of care settings and services that have happened in recent years, and our regulatory structure just has not kept pace with that, which is not to say that there haven't been similar evolutions in child services as well, but my sense is that the changes and the proliferation of different types of services in the aging market is just something quite extraordinary.
Madam Chair, I would hope that your committee and this committee could look at, I mean, they already have been implementing electronic posting of correction orders, et cetera, and that type of system, I think, could be more easily and more quickly integrated in this situation. And then, you know, we've got existing mechanisms. Let's plagiarize where we put a lot of money and effort into to try and more quickly, remedy this, because I don't want it to take years like some of the software projects and other projects. I think we need to, plagiarize other states and other systems in ours to take care of this on an expedited effort. Thank you.
Okay. I think we'll have to remember there will be differences because of children are responsible to an adult and vulnerable adults have their own choices. So we'll have to think about that, but good suggestion. Thank you. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You certainly have a large task in front of you, and I know you came in at the end of this. There's a lot of questions, so I'll just be brief. As I look through the report and I see the 17 recommendations that you agree with and want to move forward, what I'm missing there is how are people being evaluated and how many people have lost their job over this already?
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, I'm not able to comment on personnel issues to directly answer your question, but I think it would be appropriate and fair to say that we're looking at lots of things about the makeup of the workflow, certainly, which then drives a reexamination of skills that are needed at various levels, both within the office and within the health regulation division within which the office sits. So we're certainly not finished looking at what kinds of improvements to our management structure might be needed.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And follow-up to the Commissioner. I understand you can't comment on specific personnel, but you certainly could comment on payroll and amount of staff. Has anybody lost their job over this?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, I really don't think I can respond to personnel issues that are some of which are still in process.
Representative Crescia.
Madam Chair, with all due respect, okay, so has your payroll changed? Have people been moved around at all? I mean, I'll be a bulldog in this. I mean, part of what was called out in this OLA report was there was intimidation, there was management issues. I mean, there were personnel issues that were driving this, and in your 17 recommendations, I didn't see any of that that you were going to address that. Leadership drives solutions. And so, I'm not trying to be difficult, but I'm trying to help you as a way out of this. Say, are you addressing that? Let me ask it this way. Are you addressing the leadership, and I hope that are you changing people out? Because if the same managers are in place to help you drive the solutions, aren't you going to have the same problem?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, yes, we are addressing it quite directly.
Representative Crescia.
Okay, thank you. And so if I could last follow up, Commissioner, are you going to have a place or a process to evaluate, and will that be transparent so that people can see what that process is?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, I think there were so many observations made by the auditor which point us in the right direction for not only training but documentation of processes, transparency, many aspects of morale, making sure that performance evaluations are robust and completed and documented is certainly a part of rebuilding a healthy and trusting culture within the department. I certainly agree with that.
Representative Carisha.
Thank you. And again, Commissioner, I understand how difficult this job is, and I will say and I will support you. And when you have managers that are using intimidation, I mean, when this is called out in a report, intimidation and treating people poorly and driving a culture of fear, I would strongly support any action we can do to help you remove those individuals to clear the roadway. This is too important to allow people's egos to get in the way of elders being abused. And again, good luck with the job.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the report. I think that the recommendations are very clear in terms of what action we're expecting from MDH and what action we need to take as a legislature. I think sometimes those lines get blurred in terms of what can we do as a legislature, and to me these recommendations are very clear. I think that to the committee here, it's very clear that we need to get to work quickly on helping to work on this issue of oversight and jurisdiction. I think that if it's confusing for staff, it's confusing for the legislature, if it's confusing for nursing homes, I can't imagine how families must feel trying to navigate the system and find help and redress. And so I would hope that we take the recommendation for the task force seriously and get to work quickly. This is a very short session, and we're going to be hearing a lot of bills, but I think that we owe it to the public to have something ready to go when we come in as a new legislature in 2019 and be ready to put changes into place in the next legislative session. And that means it probably has to start, I don't know, tomorrow. There's a lot of work to do. I had a question, actually, I think Commissioner Malcolm answered it in terms of how do nursing homes report incidents and the resolutions, and it sounds like there is some guidelines from the federal government. I'd be really interested to learn more about that, so I don't know if others have that interest in terms of finding out what should be reported by these nursing homes, and also how we report the resolutions to the person who reported or to family members to have that communication in place. I think that's something we can look at as the task force gets underway, but very interested to hear what needs to be reported. I used to work in nursing homes, and so I remember working as a regulated entity of MDH, and we took the oversight seriously. I remember as a nursing home employee, and so very interested to hear how the federal guidelines interact with the work that's being done at the state. And then finally, I just wanted to make mention that thank you for recognizing the staff. It sounds like everybody who's talked to the staff who's doing this reporting has talked about these are folks who are in this business because they care, and I think we should all be really grateful to the people who are doing that work and trying to do the best for the vulnerable adults, and look forward to engaging these stakeholders to make sure that we put better systems in place so that they can provide that kind of care and protection for the vulnerable adults that they serve. So we have a lot of work to do, and thank you for the guidance.
Commissioner Malcolm, did you have any comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Halverson, thank you for your enthusiasm for getting to the work that we need to do together to craft a more modern regulatory framework. And I, certainly we can and will give you and the committee further detailed information if it's helpful on the types of things that are required to be reported under both federal and state law. It is a bit of a hodgepodge, but certainly can provide that in follow-up if you'd like.
Thank you. Representative Halverson. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad we're having this conversation. I don't think, you know, anybody likes what got us here, but I think we're all solution-oriented people, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate the recommendations of the OLA, and I appreciate the commissioner taking it seriously and doing the quick skim through. There wasn't a recommendation that you didn't take seriously or seem to agree with in your response, and that is noted and appreciated. And I think we take our responsibility here seriously, too, that this requires action on our part. And to Representative Halverson's part, I'm really eager to get going on that. And I think that the governor started that conversation with the task force, the consumer task force, that did put out a series of recommendations that actually does address a number of the things that came out of this report. And they've been out for a while. And so I know in our subcommittee we're going to do some further conversation, but I had a question to Chair Schumacher, but he's not here, so I'll address it to to Acting Chair Keel here today. Will we be hearing the task force recommendations that came out of the governor's task force?
Yes, we are. Our plans are to tomorrow in aging and long-term care, we'll hear from the providers, and then on the 14th of March, we will hear the consumers, the group that the governor task force, and what they want to present with that discussion and our questions there too. So, and then we will probably, well, we will hear the bills in this committee because we're, as you know from the schedule, we're running out of time. So that has to happen fast.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate the response, Madam Chair. And so, yes, so my point is just that we continue to look because what this surfaces is a place where complaints came because they happened or they were alleged. I'm very interested in making sure we don't continue to look at after the problem, but we actually start to get at the root of what caused the problem, and we start spending as much time and attention as we are. Obviously, we needed to really dig deep in what happened at OHFC. I'm not denying that. We need to do that, but I'm really concerned about actually addressing the problems where they happen, and I hope as a legislative body we take those solutions seriously and give them time to vet them, not up against committee deadline. You know, use our subcommittees and our spaces and our places to really vet real solutions together so that we can keep these problems from happening and even having to come to OHFC rather than triage complaints. I'd rather see them not even happen. So thank you.
Any comments at all, ladies? Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and, you know, thank you, the OLA. It's great. I just want to note that we just got the report today, so I haven't had a chance to read it. Nobody here has, and including Commissioner Malcolm's response. So I'm looking forward to digging more deeply into all of that because one thing that I always get from the OLA reports is it's a great way to actually understand a system because you all do a great job of kind of laying out what we actually have in place now, which is sometimes very hard to understand. A couple of questions that I have. One is for Ms. Randall and the other for Commissioner Malcolm. So, Ms. Randall, could you just talk a little bit? I don't know if it's in the report. Maybe it is, but you and I had talked briefly about the problem sometimes of even figuring out who owns a facility. And I just wonder if you could give us a little bit about that. Let us know if it's in here, but whether it is or isn't, I think we need to kind of hear a little bit about that problem because I think it's a pretty compelling piece that we're dealing with here.
Sure. Ms. Randall. Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, yes, thank you for the question. We don't dig deep into that in the report, so it's probably good to talk about it briefly. There are, I think, questions about who owns different facilities or for whom different licensed care providers work, and I think the information on that is not always transparent. On one of our site visits that we went on, there were, I think it was with an home care provider, and there were five different home care providers working in this facility or in this space, and it wasn't clear if they all reported ultimately to the same owner or to different ones, and there were multiple licenses. And so the investigator had to spend a lot of time on site. Just this was one of those trying to figure out if they had jurisdiction, because ultimately it came down to, okay, this vulnerable adult you know, here's the allegation, so it's related to this set of services, right? Who is providing that service, and then to whom do they ultimately report, and is that entity licensed by the Department of Health? So it becomes very complex very quickly. And I'll just add that the corporate structure also comes into place with the information that's posted on OHFC's website. When they post their investigation reports, they sometimes post it under the name of the corporate entity rather than under the name of, you know, Sunny Pines Nursing Home down the street. And so when we, for example, were looking for an allegation or an investigation report that we know existed, and we looked on the website and it was in the newspaper. It was a heritage house in Pequot Lakes. So the first thing we did was search for all investigation reports for providers located in Pequot Lakes. We entered that in. Nothing came up. So if I was looking for a nursing home for my mom in Pequot Lakes, I would feel great because I had just looked in Pequot Lakes and there had been no investigation reports. I would have thought I did my diligence and everybody's great there. But we knew this investigation report existed. And so we then searched under Heritage House. And two investigation reports came up, one for Heritage House in Little Falls and one for Heritage House in Malacca. So it turned out the investigation report that we were looking for related to a substantiated maltreatment allegation in Heritage House in Pequot Lakes was on the website under Minnesota Heritage House of Little Falls, and because that is the corporate entity, was located in Little Falls, and it had a slightly different name. So I think the questions about corporate structure and ownership, they matter in terms of the person at the facility trying to figure out who's accountable, but it also matters for the general public when they are trying to do the best to educate themselves when they're making important decisions. I think it is a complex area.
Right. Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you. And thank you very much. I think it's extraordinarily important that when a person's living in a facility, they should know who's responsible for that facility. And certainly the regulators ought to know. So I don't know if this is addressed anywhere, but we need to keep this on the radar. Secondly, for Commissioner Malcolm, just a quick question. We've talked a lot about the great staff in the OHFC and the problems of morale and all that. And as you know, we've had some problems with ratification of union contracts recently. And I'd just like to know if any of those OHFC staff that we're talking about that are so important to us are currently working without a contract.
Commissioner Malcolm. Madam Chair, Representative Liedling, yes, there are staff in that unit who are in bargaining units without contracts.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles, thank you for the great study and the audit. Obviously, it's already taken root, some of the good work that your staff with the commissioner, so without legislative action, so that is to be commended, Commissioner, for you in implementing some of that. Two quick questions. In your report, my question is directed to Ms. Randall. In your report, under OHFCs, they also manage hospital complaints. So first part of the question, is there any complaints from the hospitals, and how do they handle that? And then the second question is in regards to the required deadlines that in your slide, 17% were met deadlines for the two-day deadline, and then 12% of cases exceeded a 60-day deadline, and that's by federal law. And oftentimes federal law and state law, there's the funding available, obviously, and strings attached. So when those strings are cut or frayed, some of the federal funding gets cut. I suspect that that's not the case in this particular situation, so if you could validate my suspicion on that. So the question for the hospitals, and then any federal funding being suspended because they didn't meet the deadlines, which, again, I suspect was not the case. Those funds come in anyway.
Ms. Randall.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, thank you for the questions. The first one related to hospitals. Yes, they do respond to allegation reports related to hospitals. About 4% in fiscal year 17, about 4% of the allegation reports they received were related to hospitals, and 8% of the investigations they conducted. Hospitals also, however, have a different reporting system. They can use the adverse event reporting structure. So the my understanding, and the department staff may be able to talk better to this, is that most of the investigations they do in hospitals are related to licensing violations as opposed to the maltreatment allegations. And
Side note, OHFC, at least historically, has only posted on its website the maltreatment allegations, the investigation reports related to maltreatment. So there are very few investigation reports involving hospitals on the website, but they do make up a small percentage of the work they do. I had the second question in my head, and then I lost it. Can you repeat it for me?
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. It had to do with the 17% of the cases being...
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McDonald. So some of those timelines are required by federal law, as you pointed out. Some are state law. So the 60-day requirement, for example, where they only met that deadline in 12%, that's a state law. So there are some for federal and some for state. And my understanding is that the funding is not tied to them meeting those standards. There's a match that the federal government does related to the amount of investigations that OHFC does of federally certified providers. So it's more related to them fulfilling or just doing the investigation. They're not held. The money is not tied to their performance on the timelines.
Representative McDonald.
That answers my question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to clarify, just because in the introduction it mentions that that office, the OHFC, also handles complaints from hospitals, but there's few of any, if you report it, because hospitals are doing a great job with the care that they give to our vulnerable adults and all that need their services. My caveat to the good hospitals that do great work, even though I don't even go there, I stay out of there as much as possible.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Appreciate the OLA for this really comprehensive report, and it's just looking through it initially, it's much more comprehensive than I was expecting. So really appreciate a lot of good work done very quickly to Ms. Randall and your staff and Mr. Nobles. Commissioner, one of the things that really jumps out as a good recommendation from this that I think from a policy standpoint makes a lot of sense that we deal with pretty regularly is we look at complaints and facilities and how we treat people, and we tend to look at that in terms of the building and how we license a building. And if that's your mom or that's your aunt or your grandma, it really don't care who licenses that building, what jurisdiction that's under. You care that that's your mom or that's your aunt or that's your grandma. And as Minnesotans cross those agency lines for who licenses them, they don't know that, and you're either vulnerable and under the care of somebody with a license or you're not. And that recommendation makes a ton of sense, and it would seem to me that at the administration level, that would be something that your cabinet would talk about, that as vulnerable Minnesotans are crossing agency lines, that there is a strong connection that isn't building-centered but patient-centered. Has the administration talked about that, taken it seriously, moved it up, and just what are the discussions around that when you meet with the administration?
Commissioner Malcolm. Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I think that's – I'm glad that you see that as such a common-sense solution. We certainly do, too, that, and I think as Ms. Randall in her slides pointed out, what we do today is to base our regulations on the facility, not on the vulnerability of the person served. And reversing that ought to be a key design principle, whether we are whether the legislature acts on a new licensing and regulatory framework this session or passes some policy goals and law and has a task force design the details, however that might play out over the next few weeks, that design principle seems spot on and absolutely is something that we can use and should use as we continue to talk about all that we've learned through this interagency partnership and how we might think together about what recommendations we'll come forward with for regulatory reform. But I've talked to some leaders in the industry about that, about the value of patient-centered approaches. And I think I've heard a strong resonance from them that we need to adopt. Representative McDonald mentioned some of what we've learned in acute care about how to design patient-centered approaches, some tools that we have in addition to complaint investigation to really put patient-centered, person-centered care front and center. So thank you for that encouragement. We really strongly agree.
Thank you.
Chair Dean.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner, as you quickly try to respond to the OLA's report and to the work that you found at the agency, do you anticipate in the next month or weeks coming forward to the legislature with additional requests for money for addressing this year within 2018?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we are working with the governor's office and legislators right now to look at what's contained in the consumer work group recommendations. The industry has a set of recommendations. The governor's supplemental budget bill is being prepared as we speak, as you know. And, yes, there are some ideas that have been put forward to that process that are responsive to this report.
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And once again, just thanks to the OLA and to all the folks who put the hard work into that. And I would just, as a final recommendation, that as you look at the recommendations within that, anything related to IT, the further you get away from time and into the bureaucracy, the more requests we have for IT and pushing IT, and it just seems to be a recurrent and negative path to go down, that we just really try to keep the patients and families foremost in trying to help them as quickly as possible, and any immediate requests focus on the patients and not on the bureaucracy.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if you have this answer, but do you have any data trends on what types of facilities are seeing those serious allegations?
Ms. Randall.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, it's a great question, and unfortunately the answer is no. The data aren't collected in that way.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. And that's more or less what I gathered from the report. And I just find that it's very important before we start changing the regulatory process that we look at the data. And so my suggestion is that we start collecting as much data as we can so that we can make those decisions that are best. And I also think as we go through this process that all stakeholders are included in providing feedback, and so that we can develop a system that is patient-centered and that addresses all the needs of everyone else. But first, I think that we've made some great strides in addressing the OHFC office. Thank you for your work on that. But we do have to make sure that that is a functioning part of government before we start, you know, adding more things or changing more things. So I just want to make sure that we have those consistency in our policies and the transparency in reporting, working on that work until we sort of figure out what else we're going to do. So I just want to thank you for your work, and looking forward to working with you moving forward.
Commissioner Malcolm, did you have any comments?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, thank you for those remarks. And I think, again, the auditor's report really calls attention to the need to make better use of our data. We're already beginning that process of seeing what needs to be collected differently to inform those kinds of analyses going forward. And some of that will require a look at statutes governing data and how it's used. But a lot of it we can and will do right now with the resources that are already available to us.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I would just like to thank the OLA office for all the hard work and good information you always provide. We rely on it a lot, and I'll probably go to sleep tonight looking it over. And Commissioner Malcolm, I just want to thank you for recognizing that there are problems and already getting a good head start on some of the things that are going on that need to get fixed. I'm just curious about comment you made about the website, that there was no funding for it. And my question is, how is the department funded? And is monies for a website a separate number, or are you just not getting enough to put towards the website? I'm very, very cognizant of websites. I mean, we use so many of them, and that's a nice recording tool. I mean, people communicate with you. They look to do all that. And so websites have become something more than they used to be when they first came out. And so it was kind of distressing to hear that that was one area that you recognize that there isn't enough money for.
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Tice, the resources that we asked for in the legislature increased for us in the last budget were really for staffing rather than for equipment, and that so that when I say we haven't asked for funding for the website, that I do not mean to in any way minimize the financial support that the legislature has given us in two ways, with general fund increases, also increases to nursing home fees, which fund a good part of this activity as well. And there, again, is a difference between the nursing home regulatory scheme and licensure structure and the lack of the same on the assisted living side, which is a much larger group of providers. We're working through understanding what the options might be for website redesign, and I just can't speculate today on what will ultimately be in the governor's supplemental budget request, but a lot of ideas from the consumer work group, from DHS and MDH, and the legislative auditor's report are all in that mix and being discussed.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Malcolm. I just want to say I think we just need to be very cognizant, and I think you've recognized that is something we need to look to and make sure we have the funding to do that. Thank you.
Representative Stancy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think first let me start by saying thank you to the OLA and everybody who contributed to this work and this report. It's pretty eye-opening and obviously very concerning. My first question would maybe to the OLA's office, how long has this report been out?
Ms. Randall.
Madam Chair and Representative Sandstein, it was released this morning at 8 a.m.
Okay. Is it fair to say that we're all receiving this basically at the same time?
Ms. Randall.
Madam Chair and Representative Sandstein, legislators are all receiving the written report at the same time, as are the public. The agency received a draft copy 3 or 4 weeks ago, had a chance to review and respond, and we have an internal process with them.
Very good.
Representative Sandstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Peterson's question regarding data, do we have any data specifically on staffing ratios to workload issues in nursing homes in regards to incidents and reports that have been filed?
Ms. Randall, or who would like to take that? Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Tansteed, that's a great example of the type of data that we haven't collected to try to make those correlations. So that's the very kind of thing that we should look at as we design this system for ability to analyze trends, whether and how to begin collecting things such as staffing.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Tansteed. Okay, thank you. And are there any other questions from members? Okay, let's move the minutes. Representative Peterson moves the approval of minutes for March 1st. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes? Having none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. Members, there will be more conversation about this. I'd like to just make a few comments. This is a serious issue. We're talking about our loved ones that we want to have taken care of and expect to have taken care of. I am glad that the OLA pointed out that this is 18 years old to our lifespan, because often we say vulnerable, we say aging, and we need to remember that this is a huge population of people that we're taking care of. With that, I look forward to some more conversation. Members, remember that aging committee meets tomorrow morning, and we will hear from another group. I believe Representative Franzen is child care meeting tomorrow, too? Yes? Okay. And then, members, I would like to point out, as far as the Health and Human Services committee goes, the first committee deadline is approaching. So we have a lot of bills to go through. We want members to note that the committee may hold additional hearings outside of our normal times, the 13th, March 13th, March 14th, March 20th, and 21st. If these are scheduled, they will be at 5 o'clock in the evening. Pardon? After 5 o'clock, excuse me. And then additionally, we'll have added another HHS reform meeting on Wednesday, March 21st. So our committee, subcommittee times will be there at 8:15. That is normally for child care and long term. So we will be done, Chair Franzen. So actually not done. We'll just move on to HHS policy. So with that, I look forward to any and all conversations about how we work on making this more transparent, improve our accountability, and finally, most importantly, make sure that we are preventing this from even happening. So with that, members, have a good day.